This is a Dubai Eye 103.8 podcast.
Hello there and welcome to the Bite-Sized Business Breakfast. It is a Tuesday, the 6th of June, and these are the best bits of today's show on the Business Breakfast. We're going to kick off with some of our big tech stories this morning, including Apple with a new launch overnight. Then we're going to be talking about the cost of living here in the UAE. It's perhaps not a news flash to tell you that it's rising here, but we're going to get some more data on that from Vladimir from Mercer Middle East, who's going to give us the details of their latest survey. Then we're going to be talking the economics of education. Taleem, the schools operator, has got new investment from a big organisation here in Dubai, National Bonds. Alan Williamson joined us in the studio to give us the inside story. And finally, talking about sport in Saudi Arabia. Again, the business of sport in Saudi Arabia. Chris Brown, the co-founder of CBF Performance Education Management, joined us in the studio this morning. All that to come.
Talking tech, big focus on all things goggles at the moment because of the latest product launch, the first physical product launch we've had from Apple in the last 4 years. That happened overnight. That comes on the back of plenty of discussion around the world of tech. A letter released recently by San Francisco-based Center for AI Safety warning that technology could wipe out humanity and the risk should be treated with the same urgencies as pandemics or nuclear war. Well, that's been backed up by yet another influential voice overnight. Again, I mean, that was one letter, but we've had one previous to that when tech giants came together and basically said, oh, just calm down, let's just slow it down a little bit. The progress seemed to be outstripping the benefits for many. Rashik Parmar is the latest. Rashik is the chief executive of BCS, the Chartered Institute for IT. And he comes up with a different explanation as to our fear of artificial intelligence, amid claims that many people's fears are based on things like this.
My whole life I prepared my son to lead humanity in the fight against the machines.
On this night, we take back our world!
Alwis?
You know who I am?
We've been prepping for you to arrive for over a decade.
We? The Terminator.
It is nice to meet you.
I've been trying to teach him to blend in. I know it needs work.
Yeah, that's a clip from the latest Terminator, probably Terminator 27 or whatever they've up to at the moment. Basically, Rashik Parmar has said, blame films. Calls for more public education surrounding the future of AI. Amid claims that many people's fears are based on films. He actually quoted Hollywood blockbusters like Terminator and Ex Machina and said how they had ingrained public concerns about AI. I initially thought, it's a bit of a lame defence from somebody in the business. But then I thought, oh, hang on, there's a little bit of precedent here. There's a lot of people that don't get into the sea anymore because of a certain film that came out in the 1970s by Steven Spielberg that instilled a lot of fear about the shark population.
Well, not even just the film, but the novel Jaws. The guy who's the author of Jaws was so remorseful for what he had inflicted on the reputation of the shark that he, after that novel, went, I think he might have written one or two more, but he ended up basically devoting the rest of his life to rehabilitating the reputation of the shark and continually apologise for it.
And Spielberg did the same, didn't he? He did Desert Island Discs on BBC Radio 4 recently and basically said his greatest regret were in making of Jaws, obviously it was a film that helped to launch his career, but was the plight of the shark. But it has instilled fear. It's the age of, what's the tagline of Jaws? You're never alone or something like that.
No, just when you thought it was safe to go back in the water. Or we're going to need a bigger boat.
We're going to need a bigger boat. But it is this whole thing of you're not alone in the water and what lies beneath, etc. So back to Mr. Palmer's thoughts. He says this: there should be a healthy scepticism about big tech and how it is being used and how it is using AI, which is why regulation is key to winning the public trust. But many of our ingrained fears and worries also came from movies, media and books, like the AI characterizations in Ex Machina, Terminator, and even going back to Isaac Asimov's ideas, which inspired the film I, Robot. Stop watching films, you'll be fine.
Funnily enough, Snakes on a Plane has not done the same for snake reputations. Speaking of tech, I've got a question for you this morning, and it's related to our headlines, because I wrote the Spotify headline this morning. 200 people laid off. It's around 2% of Spotify's workforce. It's all to do with podcasts, the amount that they're investing in podcasts, which has been about $1 billion during the pandemic, basically isn't being earned back. I'm simplifying it a lot, but they're not making the money from podcasts, so they're changing sort of divisional bits and blah blah, and 200 people lose their jobs. Here's my question though. When I wrote the headline, I wrote that they were a tech-related firm. I did this because we like a trend, don't we? As journalists, we like being able to put things into boxes. There've been a lot of tech layoffs this way. I could call them the latest tech-related firm to lay off, which is what I did. Do they count now as a tech firm? So they are an entertainment firm. They're in the streaming business. Tech is what's enabled them, platform, app, etc. But all companies now have got a platform of some sport and are in some way tech-enabled or tech-based. I mean, do we call Careem a tech company? App, yet cars and food and motorbikes. Where's the line for what's a tech company, what's not?
It's a fair point and well made. I think of them, Spotify, as a tech company, but really they're a music company, aren't they?
Digital music service provider.
Is Careem a pizza delivery company and a get you from A to B company, or is it a tech company?
Again, I think of Careem as a tech company, but I could be wrong. I think of Soup.com as a tech company. But really, it's a
retailer.
It's a retailer in the way that, I don't know, Splash is. Yeah, it's a really valid question.
Well, and there's also the argument of how much are people like Careem and Souq and Amazon and all the rest of them actually retailers, or are they data companies?
Yeah, but you're right, because Pizza Hut's not a tech company, is it? And yet you go to your phone and you order a pizza and it comes to your door within 15 minutes, etc. And therefore, the tech is tech-enabled delivery, which Pizza Hut has invested in with their own delivery drivers, etc. They're not reliant on another service provider. I mean, other service providers are available, etc. But you're right. Every company has to have invested in tech. So therefore, does that make a pizza company a tech company?
Or a logistics company? Because maybe the key part of what they do is actually getting the pizza to you. Making the pizza is the easy part. It's getting it to Tom when he's watching West Ham in the Europa League Cup final at 11 o'clock at night. That's the tricky part, not making the pizza.
Yeah.
Maybe. Thought experiment.
No, is that, and therefore, does that make it a pizza when it arrives?
Or is it a nutrient delivery system?
Okay. Philosophy today on the Business Breakfast.
Yeah. I had this argument with the kids the other day. They are addicted to like delivery. They just can't understand, you know, food that's not delivered to the house, etc. As a treat, every single day. And I just don't do it. I don't do it because I just don't like the taste of food that's delivered to my house. I think it's not the best. It's not the quality that you'd get in a restaurant.
So you're flambeing your own crepe Suzette.
That is not a bow. The real bow is available in the restaurant. We have to go there to taste the true bow. That is just a logistics piece.
This is the Bite Size Business Breakfast, exclusively on DubaiEye1038.com.
We have for you now a bit of a world first, because Mercer's Cost of Living Index for 2023 has been put together. And more because of time zones than because we're important, we are actually breaking it here globally here on The Business Breakfast. We're the first people to have it. We're the first people to announce who is ranked where in this big piece of data we put together by the guys at Mercer to see which are the most expensive expat cities around the world. I'm not going to steal his thunder, but I am going to introduce him. Vladimir Vrovsky is the Financial Services and Technologies Industry Lead at Mercer Middle East. Vladimir, it's lovely to see you. Thanks for coming in.
Good morning.
And I'll leave the honours to you. We obviously are interested in both where Dubai and Abu Dhabi rank on this index. Where are we?
So we have seen quite a lot of movement this year compared to the previous years. And we've seen that Dubai and Abu Dhabi both have jumped in the rankings. Now, Dubai has jumped about 13 spots up to now 18th, and Abu Dhabi has jumped about 18 spots up to about 43, I believe. So there is still a large gap between actually Dubai and Abu Dhabi. However, from a grand scheme of things, what we see is that Hong Kong remained first, same as last year. Singapore is up now second. So Singapore has seen sort of that big jump from eighth or ninth place now to the second place. And that's primarily driven to the same macroeconomic issues that Dubai is facing. And then we have a mix of European and American cities in those top 10. And after that, obviously, we see a bit of a movement on the rest of the ranking. However, it's important to mention that the ranking is not only looking at the city itself, but also what can happen is that a rank can be pushed up by a lot of cities dropping below the rank, right? So technically, it's a kind of like a floating scale that we publish year on year.
Well, Richard made the point earlier that there obviously is a global cost of living crisis. Inflation has been the story for the first half of 2023. But as you say, it's how much we're rising compared to others. What is our rate of cost appreciation, if you like, doing compared to other cities?
Yeah. So I'll talk more in terms of Mercer's cost of living, right? Because our methodology is very different from a CPI methodology, right? So it's very difficult to compare apple to apple. It's not apple to apple in that case. Where we see is that on general, when we're looking at, for example, supermarket items, we're about 11% up. When we're looking at transportation, we're about 5% up. Utilities, more or less, we're at the same level. Where we see is primarily consumer items has gone up.
For the UAE?
For the UAE in general. Now, the major ticket item, where what makes the difference between Dubai and Abu Dhabi is the cost of renting, cost of real estate. Where we see is that the average are quite different, right? We see the averages in Dubai at about 25%, and that's an average compared to very different areas, right? In some areas, we see movement of about 10 to 15%. In certain, we see actually over 60% movement. If we average that out, it's about 25% overall.
And Abu Dhabi?
Abu Dhabi is a lot less. I think it's around the 10% mark. But we also see in a lot of areas in Abu Dhabi that remain flat as well.
Okay, so that's the difference between the two cities. How much of that cost growth, particularly when we're talking about real estate, about rent, is inevitable with a growing population?
I think it's very interesting that in this year's survey, Singapore and Dubai are the only cities that have an average growth in rent of over 25%. So Singapore is actually at 35%. Singapore is actually even higher than the growth rate of Dubai. And I think that's primarily driven by the lack of supply in the market, and obviously that is sort of driven by demand. Similarly here, we see that happening quite a lot. The pressure is out there, obviously. And when we add that on the rest of the ticket items in that basket, it does actually contribute a significant amount.
Okay, well, let's talk about affordability and attractiveness then, because you point out in this report that on one hand, these rising numbers are a sign of economic growth, which is great.
Yep.
But we are an expat destination. Those cities you mentioned we're in competition with in some schemes, Singapore, Hong Kong. Affordability and attractiveness is important. Are these really lists that we want to move up?
These are not the lists that we want to move up per se, right? Again, when we want to look at this in isolation, we want to look at it at a micro level. What's happening currently, right? And what's driving my cost personally. However, if we look at the grand index, we look into where would I... Organizations are typically looking at where would I place my executives? Where do I place my top talent? How do I move my talent efficiently and effectively? And that's from a cost, but also from a quality of living perspective as well. Now, we are in a good bucket in Dubai, right? Because we want to compare ourselves with the Singapores, with the Londons, with the Amsterdams, right? Because this is where the top talent sits. Now, a lot of these cities are not going through an exponential growth as Dubai would. But at the same time, we do see that would cause a bit of a pressure on organizations to understand how to compensate for that cost in particular.
All right, and that's the second half of this report,
correct,
isn't it? You speak to the HR departments, you find out what they are doing. So here in Dubai, are they compensating for cost of living?
Indirectly, yes. Directly, not. Right. So what we have actually seen is that very often organizations do not factor in inflation into their merit increase calculation. What does that mean? Is that typically we look into the economic environment. If the economic environment is good, we have post profit, we have, you know, we have grown, we would pay a higher percentage of merit increase year on year. Now, based on our survey, we have seen about 4.2% growth in base salary. But again, there's a bit of difference here when we talk about salary growth, because typically our basic salary growth, right? The compensation composition in the GCC is very different than the rest of the world, right? So if our basic salary grows at 4%, actually grows a lot less overall, right? Because we do have the housing and transportation allowances, which are sort of guaranteed. But what we've seen a big change this year is that actually we have seen the housing allowances starting being revised. And that hasn't happened for quite a lot of time. Now, it's not that every company has started revising those. However, from our survey, we have seen about 40% in that survey list that the companies have sort of decided that they need to revise their housing allowances to address a lot of the pressure that they're getting from the market. And that movement is typically between 5 and 10% on those allowances.
5 to 10%, though, in a housing allowance. I mean, rent, as you say, what did you put the average at? 25%?
25%, probably, yeah.
Is it enough?
It's not enough. However, the housing allowance was never meant to fully sort of compensate and follow the market movement. When the market dropped, we didn't really see a housing allowance reduction at the same time, right? So we're trying to see here long term what is the best way for organizations to maintain this and support the purchasing parity of employees. And they're doing that through various channels, I would say, right? One of them is adjusting the allowances, adjusting salaries, but also we have seen actually higher bonus payout last year. Of course, economic environment would play a big difference in the bonus payout, but at the same time, companies would be a bit sort of more cautious of not maybe increasing base salaries too high, knowing that the cost of living, if we call it crisis, would sort of start calming down a bit, right? The expectation is to come down. And this is why typically we have this sort of different type of movement and understanding.
Vladimir Vrovsky, unfortunately, we do have to leave it there this morning. We appreciate your time and for breaking that news first on The Business Breakfast. The financial services and technologies industry lead at Mercer Middle East, thank you.
Catch up on the business headlines with the Bite-Sized Business Breakfast.
Stop the economics of education now. Alan Williamson is the CEO of Taaleem, one of the biggest schools operators here in the UAE, live in the studio. Morning, Alan. Thanks for being with us.
Good morning. How are you?
I'm good. Thanks very much indeed. Appreciate you being with us this morning. And it's a business story because National Bonds, which is owned by the Investment Corporation of Dubai, has raised its stake in your school, Taaleem Holdings, to 22%, becoming the largest shareholder. What can you tell us about this?
Yeah, well, National Bonds have been with Taaleem a long time. They've been with us since 2007 and really since the onset of Taaleem. They are a fantastic company. They bring a lot of expertise to our board. We've got two fantastic board members who represent National Bonds. They actually lead committees and strengthen our governance. I think it shows two things. It shows the security of Taaleem with government entity shareholding, but it also shows a greater commitment to our growth story, to delivering the growth story and to the success of Taaleem as an education group.
So the share price jumping 8% yesterday on the back of this news. You IPO'd a year or so ago at 3 dirhams a share, currently at 3.6 dirhams a share. So that's not a bad outcome, I imagine, as a CEO of a listed company. Talk us through that experience of going from being a privately owned company to being a company that's listed on the stock market, if you would.
Yeah, I mean, it's been a really interesting journey for us. But Taaleem was always a very well-governed company. We've always set out clear growth strategy. We've always delivered good returns for our shareholders in terms of dividend. In terms of our management, I'll never forget our chairman, Khalid Al-Tayer, on the day that we IPO'd. He turned round to the management team and he said, focus on the strategy, not on the share price. The share price will be affected by different things over the course of our tenure as a public company. And that's what we've really done. We've focused on delivering the two new Dubai British schools that are coming up. We've closed capacity utilisation in our legacy schools, and we've increased the number of government public-private partnership schools that we're running. And I believe that the the positive news around the share price is related to people seeing the strategy coming to fruition. In addition, possibly the fee increase that was given by KHDA, which obviously allows our company to invest in teachers and retain and recruit the best teachers, but also allows a greater return for our shareholders.
Which is great for the shareholders, and I get that, because you're a CEO, but you're also a teacher. And I'm conscious of the interview that Brandy just did. Just remind us, Brandy, the cost of living rising in both Dubai and Abu Dhabi, isn't it?
Yeah, so for and parents it's mostly rents.
It's mostly rents rather than school fees, but school fees are a part of that, aren't they?
Yeah, look, it's cost of living, it's services, it's goods, it's food, it's transport, and it's rent.
How do you balance that, Alan?
Yeah, I think that's where Taleem operate in the sweet spot of the price point of the school market. We deliver the highest quality of education. Almost all of our schools are rated very good and outstanding. But we almost operate in the upper mid-market, lower premium sector. None of our schools charge super premium fees, and I believe that's why our enrollment is increasing so rapidly, because parents are deciding to choose a brand that's trusted, a brand that delivers, and one that gives value for money.
How much is your enrollment increasing, Alan? Can you put a figure on that?
Yeah, actually, year on year, we have doubled enrollment. I mean, that has never happened before. It's an incredible growth. A lot of that is in the PPP, but over the past 3 years, we've added 3,500 students to our premium schools, which is just an incredible performance.
I know you're putting that down to strategy. And fair enough, but how much of that is also down to population growth? What are you seeing in terms of people who were existing residents and people who were new residents? Can you give me a percentage split?
Yeah, it's related, undoubtedly, Brandy. One of the things that I would comment on is last year we only lost 1% of our student population in terms of attrition. Again, that's a figure I've never seen before. I think we've all been in Dubai a long time, and we know that friends and family came and went. Everybody said, I'm going to be here for 2 years. But what we're seeing is our parents are buying property. Our parents are committing to this incredible country that we live in. They're seeing the macroeconomic picture in the rest of the world and committing to the UAE. And therefore, their children are staying in the schools. And think of a business that can guarantee revenue from K to 12, 12 years of constant revenue. And that's why people are investing in an education company.
That 1% is really interesting. But again, can you tell me, with that enrollment up that you have seen, what percentage of that are new residents to the UAE? Do you have that number?
Yeah, I have that number exactly. We've been analysing this for a couple of years now. 50% of the students coming into Taleem are coming in from competition, which is possibly related to your point, Richard, that they see the value of an affordable premium education. 25% are just new children coming into the kindergarten and foundation stage. And 25% are our expat population coming into Dubai and Abu Dhabi.
So Russia is a big story here in the UAE at the moment. And I know you're a fluent Russian speaker from your previous career.
Я говорю по-русски очень плохо.
I'd love it when you do that. being serious for a second, to what extent has the influx of Russian expatriates impacted what you're doing?
Look, it's having a positive impact. We're seeing a slow growth in the Russian population in our schools. As I've said to you, we're opening 4 new premium schools, British, UK curriculum. And I'm certain that, you know, there will be a percentage of Russian students in these schools. But I would reflect you back that our highest population of students across our group is actually Emirati. And there's not another schools group that can claim that. We've got a lot of expat Arabic parents, and we've also got a lot of English United Kingdom parents in our schools. So it's a beautiful mix. There's 89 nationalities in Taleem schools, and we're very, very proud of that.
30 seconds, the war for talent. Schools in China, Malaysia, the United States want your teachers. 30 seconds on how you attract and retain them.
Dubai and Abu Dhabi are fantastic places to live. With the fee increase, we've been able to increase our teacher salaries again. The growth of the portfolio allows a teacher to come in as a young grade level teacher and go right up to being a principal. And we're very proud that two of our principals actually started as teachers in Tallinn.
Good to speak to you, Alan. Appreciate your time this morning. Congratulations on that increased investment from National Bonds. National Bonds has increased its stake in Tallinn Holdings to 22%. Alan Williamson is the CEO of Tallinn.
Just the highlights. This is the Bite-Sized Business Breakfast.
Depending on which newspapers you read, Real Madrid's Karim Benzema has signed documents to join the Saudi Arabian club Al Ittihad. They hope he will do this.
El Real Madrid, pero cómo, con qué velocidad está moviendo el balón ahí, el remate de Benzema, gol, 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 gol,
they are willing to pay a king's ransom for it as well. Again, according to which paper you read, could be anything upwards of $300 million a year. Now, that's a business breakfast story, if ever you needed one. Listen, Benzema's just the latest to join the Saudi League. Obviously, we've had some big names join in recent years, now more so than Cristiano Ronaldo a little earlier on this year. Still waiting to see what Lionel Messi chooses to do. And then yesterday, we get this huge story coming out of the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia, announced by Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman, that a Saudi sports club investment and privatization project will be put in place. The initiative aims to encourage private investment into the sports sector toward developing national teams, regional sports clubs, and practitioners at all levels. Heavy state investment into private sports club. How is this going to work? Let's get the thoughts then of our guest, the co-founder of Number 10 and the managing director of CBF Performance Education and Management is Chris Brown, joins us live in studio. Brownie, thanks for joining us.
Good morning, Tom.
Did you see this one coming or take you by surprise?
Well, completely taken by surprise. I mean, it's completely unique in its the project that they've, it's revolution really, and something not seen anywhere in the world.
That's high praise, and I mean, and that's what I wanted to ask you. Is this a different model to anywhere else? Obviously, we talk about the franchise model over in the United States. We talk about personal ownership over in Europe, etc. What's this? Is this state investment into clubs?
Yeah, basically. But although the clubs were obviously owned by the state initially, so now they're owned privately through obviously the PIF and some of the subsidiaries of the PIF. So obviously you take in the four big clubs initially, Ittihad, Al Nassr, Al Ahly,
and Al Hilal,
and then the four further clubs, and it's really a way to modernise and privatise the business of football. It hasn't been coming along as it should have done, so they've taken the necessary steps to aid this and advance it as soon as possible.
So the clubs, from my understanding and reading of it, the clubs will now be converted into companies. They'll be owned by the fund, which is, of course, backed by the PIF as well, and a non-profit institution for each club. Again, I mean, is there question marks there, the sort of muddying of the waters between business and sports?
You could say that. Take it for example, obviously in the Premier League, you wouldn't be able to own more than 30% of any two clubs. Obviously, you've got multi-club models, Man City being there and Red Bull being the obvious ones. So this is, you know, first of its kind in terms of having a number of clubs in one league under the same ownership. What happens going forward when it comes to playing in Asian competition, you know, AFC competition, I don't know, to be honest with you, at the moment, how that could affect it. But at this moment in time, I think it's a way to utilise shared services to aid the development from an investment point of view, from an infrastructure point of view, and certainly from a community aspect, fan engagement, best practices. So just completely modernising football in Saudi Arabia.
Yeah, according to the Saudi Minister of Sport, Prince Abdulaziz bin Turki Al Faisal, he said that the transfer and the privatisation of these clubs in general aims to achieve qualitative leaps in various sports in the kingdom by their 2030 vision goals, building an elite generation of athletes at regional and global levels. Is it just football, this, or is this sports in general?
No, this will be sports in general, yeah. So that 2030 vision, which I think was initially put together for 2015, so this will be across all sports. And as we know, in this region, a lot of clubs, they're not just football. They're, you know, volleyball, futsal, a number of different sports. So it'll be used for, you know, to improve all sport.
Richard Dean, football fan, economist, two different hats, put them on at the same time. Red flags here?
Yeah, they're vanity projects. They're not going to make any money. I wouldn't invest real in any of them, Chris. That's my thesis. What do you say?
Yeah, I mean, let's be honest with you. It's a huge fund that's going to put huge amounts of money in. How can you get a return on investment when you're paying someone $300 million a year when you can't, the commercial model just doesn't work to be able to pay that back, does it?
And is it going to create elite generation of athletes, as we just mentioned there as one of the goals, or is it just going to allow the likes of Benzema to come over and play in the Saudi League?
Time will tell. Obviously, they're setting out with those objectives, but we've seen it in China, haven't we, where everything just broke after paying huge amounts of money to players and building huge infrastructure. So they have to do it in the right manner. And as you say, time will tell.
I was looking for precedent a little earlier on. I was remembering about the J-League. Remember when Gary Lineker went over to the J-League and they did the privatisation? And that's when it went from companies to sort of privatised clubs almost. And we've sort of got the same thing here. Al-Qadisiyah Club will now be known as Saudi Aramco Club as well. Diriyah Club will be...
PSV in the Netherlands is Philips, isn't it?
Is the Philips, yeah.
And Philips Solverein.
Germany were basically based on organisations. But again, it's how you have this transfer at the moment moving forward. So, I mean, from a personal point of view, and given your sort of investment into sport and the setting up of two entities as well that look at the creative and the opportunities from sport, I suppose you'll be looking at this with some interest.
I certainly am, yeah. I mean, speaking to people last night in the kingdom and were involved in football and sport, there's going to be a lot of opportunities going forward for people in football, in my industry and in sport in general.
Just very finally, before I let you go, Brownie, I said, depending on which paper you're reading at the moment, all sorts of rumours doing the round. Is Benzema going? And if he is, how much is he going to get paid?
Yeah, I mean, he's definitely going, isn't he? You've got to say that. And I've got no idea. You know, what's 100 million between friends, you know? 200 or 300 million a year.
Can I borrow 100 million then, please, mate?
I'll speak to Benzema.
Good on you, Brownie. Thanks very much indeed for your time. Chris Brown joining us live here in studio, giving us his reaction to that latest news out of Saudi Arabia. Chris is the co-founder of Number 10. He's also the MD of CBF Performance Education and Management. Cheers, Brownie.
You've been listening to a Dubai Eye 103.8 podcast. To enjoy lots more from Dubai Eye in the United Arab Emirates, just go to dubaieye1038.com or find them wherever you normally get your podcasts.